This is Audible.
Blackstone Audio presents Verbal Judo, Updated Edition, The Gentle Art of Persuasion by George J. Thompson, Ph.D. and Jerry B. Jenkins. This book is read by Keith Sarabica. To all who want to leave the lives of others better than they may have found them at their worst. With a heartfelt salute to the street cops of America who have shared their skills with me. And with thanks to my family, who might have wished I had been a quicker learner. Forward by Lee Fjellstad and Pam Thompson. For the last 30 years of his eclectic life, George J. Thompson III, a.k.a. Doc Rhino, crisscrossed America with a message the world desperately needs to hear, a message of tolerance for other human beings. This message begins with empathy, the touchstone for George's verbal judo program. The new final chapter in this edition introduces George Thompson's 5 universal truths of human interaction. 1. All people want to be treated with dignity and respect. 2. All people want to be asked rather than told to do something. 3. All people want to be informed as to why they are being asked or ordered to do something. 4. All people want to be given options rather than threats. 5. All people want a second chance when they make a mistake. This global message promoting respect, understanding, and forgiveness can connect all people everywhere. But we need a vehicle to develop understanding, and using our words for a defined purpose can create the forward momentum. Verbal judo can help in every profession and can greatly enhance our personal lives. George Thompson shared a belief with the ancient Greeks that action follows philosophy and that what we believe will dictate our actions in life. Thompson advocated that the more different we are from others, the more tactically we must speak in order to gain compliance, develop cooperation, or work in collaboration. Tactical civility better supports our actions and lessens resistance to new ideas or even change. By truly believing and advocating the philosophy of respect for others, we can maintain our tactical position even in adversarial situations, while allowing others to disagree and keep their dignity. Verbal judo strategies and tactics can help in so many ways to turn reactionary situations into winning situations. History classes are full of accounts of wars caused by the desire for land and resources. But many times these wars have been fought over simple disrespect. With anger becoming a new type of danger, the ability to speak calmly and persuasively has never been more necessary than now. The digital age has fundamentally changed how we must conduct our affairs in both professional and personal interactions. Our words are now carried to the masses, and our mistakes and errors in judgment are public and recorded, if we say things we'll later regret. The philosophical foundation of verbal judo promotes using language to achieve a professional purpose, and to do so with real power and empathy. We build a bridge that will promote dignity and respect. Recognizing the need for respect and the preservation of dignity of others are crucial in every personal and professional encounter, from police toward lawbreakers, business competitor toward competitor, parents toward children, student toward teacher, doctor toward patient, and vice versa. George Thompson never wanted people to confuse sympathy with empathy. We can feel the pain of others by merely asking ourselves how we would feel under identical circumstances. Verbal judo does not require turning the other cheek or the use of touchy-feely language, and does not push political correctness. We must communicate our purpose, but we are not required to respect wrongful actions. In law enforcement classes, Thompson was quick to state that those in the profession of bringing order from chaos cannot possibly be expected to respect the actions of hardened criminals against hapless victims. We must, however, respect their individual or collective constitutional rights. We must ensure the proper course into the courtroom and not compromise subsequent convictions with any action that undermines our professional goal. To quote a police officer from North Dakota, "We treat people as ladies and gentlemen, not because they are, but because we are." What separates professionalism from amateur behavior is giving our opponent no solid grounds to make a stand against us, with our comments or actions. A scholar turned police officer turned police trainer, George Thompson created Verbal Judo and was president of the Verbal Judo Institute, Inc., which he founded in 1984, for over 30 years. Doc trained his first associate in 1985, followed by many others, all dedicated to teaching his principles with the same enthusiasm and commitment to changing how we view conflict and resolution. Institute clients expanded quickly beyond the arena of law enforcement into corporations and business, the airline and cruise industries, the medical profession, and the field of education, and have become hugely popular with government employees in city, county, and federal offices. Operations were developed and expanded outside North America, with offices in Australia, Africa, and Scandinavia, and the books have been published in several languages, making the reach of Verbal Judo global. Since 1984, over 1 million people have sat in Verbal Judo classes, and hundreds of thousands more have read the books, watched the videos, and listened to the audio versions of the principles and tactics of Verbal Judo. The life work of George Thompson has become a force of its own through Verbal Judo and the Verbal Judo Institute, Inc. Imbued with his spirit, the program will continue to spread and envelop the world, one person, one profession, one nation at a time, until his vision is complete. The Institute will continue to promote new writings, new video and audio works, and new programs to meet the demands of a world that seems sometimes on fire. We at the Verbal Judo Institute, Inc., and our Verbal Judo family thank all our clients who have supported us over the decades. We will be here always with the message George wanted us to carry into the future. We thank all of you for your continued support of Verbal Judo, with Pam Thompson now the CEO, and your continued vigilance in helping us protect Dr. Thompson's legacy. The sad passing of Dr. George J. Thompson III has left a hole in our hearts, but his program and ideals will move forward. We promise. Lee Fjellstad and Pam Thompson, and the rest of our family in the United States, Mike Manley, Doug Haig, Steve Wappershaw, William King in Australia, Darcy Pennock in Canada, Bo Munta in Sweden, and Don Gold in Africa. Please visit the Verbal Judo websites, verbaljudoglobal.com and verbaljudoinstituteinc.com. A decade later. This little volume you are holding in your hands, Verbal Judo, The Gentle Art of Persuasion, battled to survive when it was first launched into the crowded book marketplace in 1993. But little by little, readers began to embrace its hope-filled message of better relationships and better communication through empathy. Our seminars and training sessions began to swell with more and more enthusiastic participants, and word spread that this Verbal Judo stuff really works. We know the book's impact from the hundreds of letters and emails we have received over the past decade. We know of its power from the many testimonials from our seminar participants, many of whom have come to the course more than once. As one put it last year, "You know, Doc, Verbal Judo changed my life, but I need to hear its gospel every 2 years or so." Another wrote me, shortly after attending a training session, "Thanks for saving my relationship with my teenage son. When I got home, I sat down and talked to my son, really for the first time in years. Verbal Judo turned me around. Thank you." And then there was the police officer who attended my 5-day instructor course. On day one, a Monday, he informed me, "I'm getting a divorce next week." By Thursday night, he called me at my hotel to tell me, "You know, Doc, this course has hit home. I called my wife just now and told her we are putting off the divorce and heading to counseling, something she had wanted and I hadn't. I have learned I'm the problem, and I value my wife and kids and intend to make the necessary changes." A year later, I got a Christmas card from him and his wife, happily together. Such responses make me more committed than ever to sharing the powerful techniques in this book so they can benefit as many people as possible. During this past decade, I have personally trained thousands of police officers in hundreds of departments, ranging from LAPD in San Diego to Chicago, NYPD, and Miami-Dade County, to mention only a few. Verbal Judo is now required police training in most states, and the officers who use it are safer and more professional. But Verbal Judo is more than just good training for police and other emergency personnel. It's useful for anyone. Years ago, I modified it for the business and corporate world, And now my staff routinely teaches service professionals, airline personnel, state and federal employees, realtors, and anyone who works in the potentially hot arena of public service, sales, or business. School teachers and administrators can greatly benefit from this training, as could doctors and medical staffs across the country. Even our kids need this training, which is why I'm developing a course specifically for them. To further illustrate the need for verbal judo, I would like to share a personal experience. I recently underwent throat surgery for cancer. I lost my left vocal cord, and with it my ability to speak professionally, but I am now cancer-free. I spent 15 days in the hospital, frail and weak from the surgery, watched over by perhaps 20 or so nurses, doctors, and students. I couldn't sleep, I couldn't eat, and I could barely move. The quality of care was terribly uneven, ranging from awful to acceptable, with only one excellent. Nowhere was the need for verbal judo training more evident. Hardly anyone seemed to have empathy for those of us who were hurt and scared. We were just beds. Cold and impersonal was the norm. Just a little human contact or a kind word would have made such a difference. And that difference is exactly what this book has to offer. The entire basis of verbal judo is to treat people with dignity and respect. Most of all, your family and close friends. Be ever so careful how you speak to them, as words can cut deeper and fester longer than sword wounds. Ironically, we often spend less energy being kind to those closest to us. Change it. I learned again in the hospital what I've always striven to teach and know myself. In this life, the most important thing you have is your relationships with people. Verbal judo can help you maintain those relationships and improve the quality of your life and the lives of those around you. It has saved lives, marriages, and careers, and it can work for you too. Use it. Introduction. Communication as a non-contact sport. The last thing Dr. George J. Thompson wants is for verbal judo to be merely an entertaining collection of true-life cop stories. Admittedly, it has its share of back-alley fights suddenly neutralized with left-field offers, suicide attempts derailed by wily candor, and domestic squabbles diffused by a cop who knows how to intrude and do nothing. But verbal judo is much more. A former college English literature professor, George Thompson is a black belt in both judo and taekwondo karate. A combination that made one unusual police officer when he first put on a badge at age 35. Today, through his Verbal Judo Institute, he primarily trains cops how to use their mouths instead of their nightsticks and guns. He is also in demand by school teachers, hospital administrators, salespeople, and business executives. He has trained people at organizations ranging from IBM to the FBI, and from the U.S. Forest Service to Metropolitan Life. It is cops on the street, though, whose lives hang in the balance if they don't use language properly. Among George Thompson's students have been 6,500 members of the Los Angeles Police Department. In fact, the four officers videotaped in the Rodney King incident were 1 week away from taking his verbal judo class. George Thompson believes that violence could have been avoided had the officers spent a day in his classroom. In training tens of thousands of officers throughout the United States, George Thompson has developed foundational, state-of-the-art communication skills that are easy to learn and will work for anybody. He believes that verbal judo principles can save ordinary citizens unnecessary conflict, tension, and abuse. This book is intended for anyone who wants to reduce stress by using the most effective and powerful communication techniques available today. It is for people who like to get what they want by using responsible means, whether convincing a contractor that they have been overcharged or getting a boss to stop sexual harassment. Verbal judo also effectively teaches parents how to motivate their children to do better in school or how to protect themselves on the street. Verbal judo is designed for people who want more open and satisfying relationships with their families, their colleagues, their employees, and their friends. Its techniques for establishing rapport and empathy can also help people enjoy improved relationships. It is not uncommon for students to approach George Thompson after a class and ask, "Where were you two marriages ago?" Verbal judo is a manual for those who want a powerful communication breakthrough that can improve their lives. What differentiates Verbal Judo from other books on communication is that it offers solutions that work when people are under pressure. It provides techniques that have been tested on the street by men and women responding to life-or-death situations. Verbal Judo can develop in you habits of thinking and acting that George Thompson developed in his extensive study of the martial arts. It blends the best of an Eastern-style mindset, particularly the notion of using the energy of negative situations, with such Western philosophies as the Golden Rule and even Aristotelian rhetoric, which Dr. Thompson studied in postgraduate work at Princeton. Verbal Judo will teach you to respond, not react, to situations. Using what George Thompson calls the most dangerous weapon on the street today, the cocked tongue, you will learn to adapt and be flexible, just as practitioners of physical judo do. You will learn to use your words to redirect the negative force of others toward positive outcomes. You don't have to understand complex philosophies to become proficient in verbal judo. George Thompson teaches by simple example, through his own real-life experiences. He tells how he and other salty old police dogs cleverly talk their way out of danger, and he provides amusing anecdotes from his years as a parent, trying to outwit three gifted children. In verbal judo, you'll learn to speak with anybody without causing or escalating conflict. You'll learn to praise without sounding manipulative, and you'll learn to constructively criticize with more empathy so people remember what was said with less injury to pride in their feelings, become motivated to change, and continue to feel like valued team members. Verbal judo also has solutions for dealing with people under the influence of liquor, drugs, fear, rage, or plain stupidity. With George Thompson's tactics for mind-mouth harmony, you will learn far more than how to throw words around to live more safely in a treacherous world. You will learn a new habit of mind, a gentle approach taking control of situations without creating stress, without frustration, and without conflict. As he clarifies in Chapter 17, "Nowhere did I learn these principles more clearly than on the streets as a cop. I use a lot of police examples, because I believe it is easy to transfer the principles to everyday civilian situations. My hope is that people might see police anecdotes as the essence of verbal judo in stark clarity. In other words, if it doesn't work on the street, you can't use it in the home or at the office. And if it does work on the street, well, see for yourself." Chapter 1. Birth of a Communication Samurai. It was the most outrageous way to bust up a fight I had ever seen. I'd been a rookie cop 10 days when my partner got the call. At 2 a.m., we were dispatched to break up a nasty domestic dispute in a tenement on the east side of Emporia, Kansas, notorious for drug dealing and random violence. We could hear the couple's vicious mouth-to-mouth combat from the street. My training sergeant and partner, Bruce Fair, and I approached and peeked through the half-open door. Then Bruce just walked in without bothering to knock. I watched as he strode past the warring couple, took off his uniform cap, sighed, and planted himself on the couch. Ignoring the argument, he picked up a newspaper and thumbed through the classifieds. Leaning against the door with my hand on the butt of my .357, I was flabbergasted. Bruce seemed to violate all the rules of police procedure. I had never seen him enter a house without identifying himself, without asking permission, or without at least saying why he was there. There he was, treating an angry couple in a tenement apartment as if he were a visiting uncle. Bruce kept reading and the couple kept arguing, occasionally glancing at the cop on their couch. They had yet to notice me. As the man cursed his wife, Bruce rattled the newspaper. "Folks, folks, excuse me, over here." The stunned husband flashed a double take. "What are you doing here?" Bruce said, "You got a phone? Look here, a 1950 Dodge, cherry condition. Can I borrow your phone? I know it's late, but I don't want to miss out on this. Where's your phone? I need to call right now." The husband pointed to the phone, incredulous. Bruce rose and dialed, then mumbled into the phone. He slammed it down. "Can you believe they wouldn't talk to me just because it's 2 a.m? By now, the fight had evaporated, the couple standing there as dumbfounded as I was. "By the way," Bruce said pleasantly, as if just becoming aware, "is anything the matter here? Anything my partner and I can do for you?" The husband and wife looked at the floor and shook their heads.
Not really, no.
We chatted with them a bit, reminding them it was late and that everyone around would appreciate a little peace and quiet. Soon we were on our way. Then I was really puzzled. Earlier that night, we had broken up a similar dispute in the classic cop fashion. We quickly took control with polite authority, performed what's known as a separate and suture, where the warring parties are separated, calmed, and then brought back together, and diffused the situation.
That was the way I had been trained, so what was this new twist?
I mean, as a former college English professor who had taught Milton and Shakespeare for 10 years, I'd seen some ingenious twists of plot. But a cop taming two animals by intruding as a rude but friendly guest? Bruce had forced those people to play host to him, whether or not they wanted to. As soon as we were back in the squad car, I asked him, "What in the world was that all about? Why did we separate and suture earlier and pull this crazy newspaper and telephone gag just now?" He shrugged.
"I don't know. I've been on the street more than 10 years. You just learn."
"Hey, maybe I'm new at this," I said, "but I'm no kid." I was 35. "I haven't got 10 years. I could get blown away if I tried that stunt. We need to talk. Tell me how you knew you could get away with that." I didn't realize it then, but that evening marked the birth of verbal judo and was the first lesson in my career as a communication samurai. I had studied the martial arts, starting with genuine Indian wrestling, since I was 6, and held black belts in judo and taekwondo karate. But I had never seen such principles so effectively applied to life on the streets. It was one thing to practice the martial arts in a storefront dojo with polite, honorable opponents bowing and working together, competing and learning. In judo, I had learned the gentle art of redirecting my opponent's energy to achieve my own goal. If he came straight at me, I would sidestep and try a move that would add to his momentum, carrying him past me where I could take control. But I had watched Bruce Fair do virtually the same thing without an ounce of physical force. With his mouth, a newspaper, and a telephone, he had calmed two hotheads with redirective techniques he had absorbed through experience. I was intrigued. During the remainder of my tenure as a police officer, working everything from canine patrol to hostage negotiations, I carefully watched and listened to guys like Bruce. I began systematically studying the communication techniques of salty old police dogs, carrying a tape recorder with me on every call. I listened not only to what was said, but also to how it was said. Time after time, I saw older, street-savvy officers assume roles and counter-roles, suavely manipulating people's energies to calm otherwise dangerous situations. I quickly became convinced that good police officers are the greatest communicators in the world. They often have to issue orders and elicit compliance from hostile subjects, as when they're derailing a drug deal and the gang members are reaching for their AK-47s. Despite my classical education, which had exposed me to the finest rhetoricians of the ages, I realized that my real postdoctoral work hadn't been done at Princeton. It was unfolding for me right on the streets of Emporia. "I've made every mistake you can make in communication, so I'm no guru addressing you from a state of perfection. Rather, I'm someone who's finally learned from his mistakes. If I can save you the kind of hassle I've endured, I'll consider this endeavor a success. I have 3 overarching goals. First, and most important, is to ensure your personal safety. Developing mind-mouth harmony is the greatest skill in the world, because if you make a mistake with either, you can find yourself in serious personal danger. You can lose a marriage, stall a career, instigate violence, lose your credibility, alienate people, and lose friends.
I know. I've done them all.
Whether you are an executive or a homemaker, verbal judo, if for nothing else, is designed to keep you alive. Admittedly, police officers, the primary audience for my course over the years, are much more vulnerable to violence than the rest of us. In the last 10 years, 855 police officers were killed in the line of duty, and more than 700 times that number wound up in emergency rooms across the country. We know from research that almost all of those injuries began with mind-mouth disharmony. That's why I tell cops that the most dangerous weapon they carry is not the 9mm or the .357 or the pump shotgun. Their most dangerous weapon is the cocked tongue. More on that later. Goal number two is to enhance your professionalism. Regardless whether you're in retail, wholesale, on a police force, part of corporate America, or working at home, you're a professional. Everything I offer here can measurably improve your performance by reducing complaints from those you work with and reducing your personal stress. If you can learn to use your words without causing strife and conflict, you will have fewer complaints in the work world and fewer arguments with your friends and family. This will go a long way in reducing stress, which is something you usually bring on yourself by the way you deal with people. Reduce your capacity for conflict, and you will reduce stress. My third goal is to increase your efficiency by improving your performance level. This will have the added benefit of improving your self-esteem, the way you view yourself. Increasing your efficiency also means improving your ability to say it right the first time, rather than, as so many of us do, having to apologize, restate, and try to explain why you fired off words that caused you problems in the first place. If there was one thing I didn't like about my academic colleagues, it was that too few of them could practically apply what they taught. You can imagine what they thought of me, this strange guy who liked to ride along with cops and play at judo and karate on the side. I might have felt like a fish out of water in both the academic and the law enforcement worlds if I hadn't come up with a communication system that ties them together. Chapter 2. Motivating the Disagreeable. So you'll see that I'm trying to teach you with your own best benefit in mind. Let me tell you briefly what I've come to realize over the years about teaching. Teaching is the process of moving people from what they know to what they don't know. And I found the best way to teach a motivated student is to appeal to his consciousness with a very small element of language, a metaphor and a simile, which is understandable to him so he can understand what is being taught. A dry, boring teacher talks about what he knows, as if the student should have a clue. The student makes no movement. He hears the teacher talking about something the teacher may know well, but unless that teacher compares it to something within the range of that student's experience, little learning takes place. At the other end of the spectrum, and also unacceptable, is the teacher who moves students from what they know to other areas they already also know. I'd always been taught that a teacher masters his material, goes into the classroom, and presents it. The teacher presents, the student receives. If the student doesn't get it, he fails. But that's not the way the real world works. In the real world, a teacher has to know his audience and start where they are, taking them to where they haven't been. When you use verbal judo, you have an audience. You have someone on whom you practice verbal judo. Your audience may not be a class full of kids, but an office full of employees. Maybe you're dealing with an audience of one, your boss or your spouse. Maybe it's a difficult child, or a tough landlord, or a problem neighbor. Regardless, like the cop on the street, you have to read your audience, know your principles, the tools with which to accomplish what you want in the situation, then decide which of the many methods will make your principles affect the outcome you want. Often the best way of reading your target audience is to see the person the way he sees himself, which is the true essence of empathy. Then, using the language of your audience, you can make the strange become familiar. Albert Einstein was brilliant at that. He would sit in Princeton Square and use balloons and oranges to explain the most complicated ideas. Carl Sagan does much the same. Great, profound thinkers must communicate simply. They understand the complexities, but they must make them simple so everyone can understand. For example, you'll see case histories here where a cop is trying to calm a frightened, potentially violent troublemaker. In the classic macho approach, the cop would challenge the guy. "Put that knife down or I'll take you out. You haven't got a chance. I'll blow your head off." Things like that. That virtually forces the man to attack, to defend his manhood, to save face. But what if that cop gently empathizes and says, "Hey, friend, let's do each other a favor. You don't want to spend the night downtown with us, eating our food, sleeping in our steel cot, and missing your woman. And I don't want to sit at a typewriter for a couple of hours doing paperwork on this. If we can work this out, you can have dinner at your own table, be with your woman,
and wake up in your own bed tomorrow morning, and I can go back about my business. You'll come to see how this works, how the perpetrator becomes an ally with the officer to the benefit of both. What has happened? The officer has motivated a disagreeable person to a point of voluntary compliance, the ultimate goal of verbal judo. If you can see how learning that skill would improve your relationships and your life, you're a motivated student who has picked up the right book. Chapter 3. Baptism of Fire. My background is the strangest mix of the physical and the cerebral that I'm aware of. I'm a middle-aged jock with a chip on his shoulder who could just as easily scream in your face and wrestle you to the floor as smile and calm the situation with a well-chosen word. Don't I sound like an English PhD? I'm just like you. If I get cut off in traffic, my first impulse is revenge. If someone barks at me, my first reaction is to take his head off. Problem is, like most sane people, I'd regret it. It took me a while to realize that an expert on the art of verbal judo should be a man who needs it. Yeah, I do. It makes me chuckle to realize how quickly I can shake a fist or a digit at another driver while on my way to the airport to fly somewhere and teach my course on proper responses to negative situations. I still say that makes me the right guy for the job. The success of my Verbal Judo Institute allows me to look back with gratitude, and not regret, on an upbringing that might have made another guy bitter. I was the product of a soldier and his wife whose marriage soured before I turned 3. My mother gave a porter a few dollars and asked him to watch out for me on a California to New York train ride to my grandparents in Ithaca, New York. I recall growing up pretty much alone, walking the ravines as a mountain boy. One of the most significant things that happened to me was hooking up with an old Cherokee who taught me to trail and track. I.D. Swiftwater felt he owed my grandfather a debt of gratitude because my grandfather, a Cornell University law professor, while a student years before, had done some pro bono legal work for him and kept him from losing his 40 acres. So Swiftwater took me under his wing, and I enjoyed the rare privilege of learning Indian ways. While being raised in the home of an Ivy League educator, where I read widely every day and learned to speak correctly, I was one bitter kid. I had no idea I was getting a most unusually well-rounded background, with my grandparents' emphasis on schooling, the genteel world of higher education, and my inclination toward athletics. I felt rejected by my mother and a burden to my grandparents. From nursery school on, my records paint a picture of the real George Thompson, the child I recognize inside me today, with a hot temper and short fuse, has trouble getting along with others, etc., etc., etc. Two philosophies warred within me: take no crap from anyone, and look out for number one. I hated school. I was always challenging, always asking why, never doing what I was told before demanding a reason. I wanted to win all arguments, all fights, all games. My record was full of dire predictions. In high school, I was a star athlete, an All-American swimmer, but still I had never applied myself to my studies. In the fall of 1959, as I began my senior year, a counselor took me aside, an old woman who had tried everything to get through to me. She said, "You may be some hot-shot swimmer, but you're going to be a bench sitter in life. No college is going to accept somebody with your grades, and you're never going to amount to anything." I sat there sullenly waiting for the lecture, the remedy, the typical, "So you had better start applying yourself, young man," routine. But it never came. That was it. She was finished. She had pronounced judgment on me. They had tried everything to get through to me. I was worthless and wouldn't amount to anything, so best of luck. She's probably long dead now, so I'll never find out. But to this day, I don't know if she was cunning enough to know that challenging me like that was my only hope. I stormed out of there determined to show her. And I did. I became a straight-A student overnight and was accepted at several prestigious colleges. I chose Colgate, where I majored in English. I still had an attitude, but I was learning to channel my anger and aggressiveness into more socially acceptable pursuits. I enjoyed reading and learning, thinking, analyzing, and discussing. Upon graduation, I wanted to teach. When a position opened at Princeton, New Jersey High School, I went for it.
I had no idea what I was getting into or how it would help shape my life. I was to teach English and reading, including one remedial class. No one told me that the previous teacher had been beaten up and left bleeding in his car. I didn't learn till later that a woman teacher the year before had been dangled by her ankles from the second floor window. This was a class that chewed up teachers and spit them out. Non-academic general students. These were seniors, anything but college-bound. I thought they'd enjoy true life action, so I gave each student a copy of a book on men in war called God is My Co-Pilot. It was 8:05 in the morning, and I was not quite 22 years old. A minute later, a huge black kid named Pete stood and ceremoniously ripped the paperback in half. "I ain't reading this crap," he said, and let the pages flutter to the floor. The rest of the students, every one of them, immediately followed suit. Now what? I wasn't going to be able to beat up 30 kids, much as I would have liked to. And if I sent them to the principal's office, I would expose myself as a wimpy disciplinarian. Talk about motivation. I had no clue, no training. The class looked at me with defiance, as if daring me to do anything. In sheer desperation, I pointed to Pete and called him Jack. "What's your thing, Jack?" I said. He glared and narrowed his eyes. "Huh? What do you do for a living that makes you good enough to rip up a man's book?" "Mechanic," he said. "Is that right?" I said. "An auto mechanic?" He nodded. "Best in town." "No kidding. What if I told you I don't believe a word you said?" "About what?" "I am a mechanic." "About being the best in town." "Ask anybody." "How about you prove it?" "Like how?" "Well, I'll tell you what. Since you don't want to read any books, you're on tomorrow." "On what?" "You're the teacher," I said. "You bring a carburetor in here and teach this class. If you're the best, you ought to be able to teach us what you do." "You kidding me?" I stared him down, shaking my head. "You got it," he said. I should have been suspicious the next day when he showed up with the carburetor, still dripping gas, wrapped in a newspaper. It didn't hit me where he'd gotten it until I overheard another teacher later in the day complaining that something was missing from his engine. Pete didn't wait for an introduction. He strode to the front, told me to sit down, and plopped the carburetor on the table. "Everybody shut up," he said. I never understood or cared much about auto mechanics until Pete began. Suddenly, in his area of expertise, he was eloquent. He spoke with passion and knowledge. He not only knew his stuff, but he was also able to explain it. Afterward, I told him how well he had done, and asked what he knew about race car carburation.
"I don't know," said it's different.
"Find out, and you'll be on again next month."
"I don't have no race cars to work on."
"I don't care what you find out. Try the library." He swore,
"I ain't been to no library, and I ain't going to no library."
"I don't care where you get your information, but find out and teach us." I asked another kid, who said he was a pool player, to demonstrate for us. I brought in a small pool table, and this guy, who was flunking his math classes, told us more about angles and drag and friction than I had ever known. I challenged him to study up on some of the great pool players for a second presentation. One of the girls talked about her work in a local bakery. One of the hill kids told about trapping. On Fridays, I talked about morality and ethics and demonstrated what I knew of the martial arts so the kids would know who was really in charge. For the first 30 class days, I didn't do much of anything but listen to the kids talk about what they enjoyed the most. When it was Pete's turn again, he showed up with note cards. I had said nothing about note cards. "What are you doing with those?"
"That lady in the library said they would help my presentation," he said. "You know they got a whole section on automotive down there? Now you want me to teach you what?"
Eventually, each student taught twice. Meanwhile, I was ordering books on their areas of interest. Soon they were reading and writing, two things I had said little about. Pete began carrying around a pocket dictionary, badgering me about any word he didn't recognize. He wound up going to Central State in Ohio. Too many people who teach have no idea the principle of teaching. The goal of education is to expand the mind. A person's mind cannot be expanded unless he or she is motivated. There are many ways to motivate a person, but there is only one underlying principle. Raise expectations. Almost without knowing it, I raised the expectations of those students. They saw themselves as losers, unmotivated, uncaring. When they were challenged to do something, to show off their expertise, they gained confidence and were even motivated to expand, to learn something more. Their expectations of themselves had been raised. Beside that, I was also learning things about teaching I had never been taught in the classroom. Admittedly, much of it was theoretical and perhaps even esoteric, but it was eye-opening for me. I was learning that while there may be hundreds of ways to get something done, for instance, motivating a student, there was but one underlying principle: raise his or her expectations. Later, I would apply that hundreds of ways but just one principle to my chosen area of expertise, verbal judo. For instance, there are hundreds of ways to calm someone down, but if you know the one underlying principle, the one hoping to do the calming must project empathy, you can decide, case by case, which method best fits the principle for the person in question. I'll get into all those principles and how to best implement them, but my point here is to show how my teaching consciousness was born. Though I was barely aware of it at the time, my most difficult, most challenging classroom full of rebels taught me more about teaching and communicating than I would learn until I became a cop. Chapter 4. Taking Crap with Dignity and Style. The kids in that remedial reading class were part of what I call the Great Why Way. If you have children, you will go or have gone through this stage. It begins as early as age 11 and sometimes never ends. That kid you used to be able to advise and coach and direct suddenly becomes a why guy. He or she has become just like the street lizards the beat cops encounter every day. They question every statement, every command, even every suggestion. May I see your license, please? May sound like a perfectly legitimate request to you or me, but there's always someone who reacts not with, sure, here it is, but with, why? What'd I do? Society is full of these people, from your teenager to your spouse, your client, your subordinate, your neighbor. There is more on these types of people and others in the next chapter. We are forced to become persuaders, and no one is trained in persuasion. Until now. That's my goal. I want to expand your mind, and so I need you motivated. The fact that you're still reading is an indication that you have a desire and a certain expectation. I'm telling you, if I can do this, you can do it. If I can become a practitioner of verbal judo, anyone can. If that raises your expectation, makes you believe you can learn and improve your skills and thus succeed, you're a motivated student. The Gentle Way. Verbal judo begins with a habit of mind. In Japanese, ju means gentle and do means way. Thus, judo means the gentle way. That definition is a surprise to many who assume that the meaning of words like judo and karate must necessarily be warlike and aggressive. Even karate, which is widely associated with B-movies full of violence and mayhem and all manner of death blows, literally means open hand or empty hand. The martial arts are self-defense techniques, not kill mechanisms. As you learn verbal judo, the gentle way of persuasion, through a series of absolute principles, you'll form new habits of mind that will guide you to becoming a consciously competent speaker. You'll discover that it's possible to have a good communication day every day. Though I have carefully studied this for years and will present to you everything I know about it with all my educational principles in mind, it probably won't seem natural to you at first. That's because truly enlightened communication does not come naturally to anyone, at least not to anyone I've ever met. Of course, I never met Gandhi. Thus, I always warn people in my classes, never use words that rise readily to your lips, or you'll make the greatest speech you'll ever live to regret. Remember that glib phrase George Bush was so fond of during his 1988 campaign? Read my lips, no new taxes, seemed to just roll off his lips. It may be the greatest speech he'd live to regret. Because I teach you to be careful of the words that rise automatically to your lips, the verbal judo that you substitute will initially feel foreign to you. but as you gradually learn new thinking habits and corresponding language, they will eventually feel comfortable and become automatic. As you learn to choose and deliver your words for maximum effectiveness, you'll enjoy benefits beyond merely improved communication. You'll find that you can remain calm, which is a particularly valuable art. If your antagonist can upset you, he owns you at some level. Even if you score an immediate victory by telling him off, he may own you later when the encounter is evaluated by your boss, in court, by your family, or wherever. Cops often learn this the hard way. What they thought was a good arrest Friday night might be worthless in court Monday morning because of something they did or said. You'll get plenty of good and bad examples as we go on. As a student of verbal judo, you'll also learn how to talk with people in such a way that neither of you loses face. This is crucial because personal face is always a fighting issue, whether the conflict occurs on the street or in the boardroom, in court or in the bedroom. You'll also discover surprisingly simple phrases that establish immediate empathy, and you'll recognize conflict as a gift, a communication game that helps you learn to master yourself. You'll soon be able to use words that immediately establish your credibility with strangers. With friends, family, and associates, you'll know what to say to strengthen relationships, especially when those bonds are under pressure. You'll even learn to talk smoothly to people with whom you totally disagree. With verbal judo, you will learn to get what you want by using the dual powers of mindset and words. In essence, you can become a master of communication, both internal and external. This is no small accomplishment. Verbal judo will allow you to fulfill your dreams and wishes without creating stress, frustration, or conflict. In the meantime, you'll never again mentally beat up on yourself by moaning, "Why didn't I keep my big mouth shut?" The Sucker Punches of Life. The secretary habitually lies and says the boss is in a meeting and can't take your call. The youthful put-down artist advises you to chill out and get a life. The alleged friend suggests, "We've got to get together for lunch," but is always booked when you try. Welcome to some of the standard sucker punches of life. And this is the little stuff. As with cops, the most dangerous weapon you carry is a cocked tongue. It can fire off a sentence that will stall or even ruin your career. It can start a fight in the street, and I have the scars to prove it. It can send you to divorce court, and I have those scars, too. While your body can usually recover from physical blows, the bad news is that emotional wounds inflicted by words are likely to remain in your memory forever. The good news is that with training, you can learn to take crap with dignity and style. Few of us can claim that there isn't any such garbage coming our way. The question is not whether such attacks will come, but how you will deal with them. Are you going to handle them with grace and ease, feeling in the end that everyone benefited? Or will you come away feeling like a wimp, a bully, a loser, an idiot, or all the above? If you learn to take taunts or criticism effectively, you won't even have to worry about other verbal judo techniques, such as deflecting. While such skills are important and good, they aren't always necessary. With practice, you can learn to take insults with so much finesse and panache that they either disappear or never touch you. As the Confucian philosopher Sun Tzu put it, "To win 100 victories in 100 battles is not the highest skill. To subdue the enemy without fighting is the highest skill." A modern example of this surfaced in the 1990 Texas gubernatorial campaign of Clayton W. Williams, Jr. In Texas, the word Bubba is a generic term used to describe redneck good old boys, and Williams was accused of pandering to the Bubba vote. Rather than argue the point, he gleefully responded, "I am Bubba!" That approach turned the tide and almost won him the election. The first step in learning to deal with verbal attacks is to acknowledge that crap is being flung. The second step is to admit it is being flung at you. Then congratulate yourself. It's okay to be questioned, heckled, or even attacked. If you are willing to take it, you should be commended. The only way to avoid criticism is either to live in a capsule or spend your whole life trying to please everyone. That means playing it safe, surrounding yourself with sycophants, taking few responsibilities, and doing what other people tell you to do. The moment you have an idea and try to persuade others to move in concert with you, you have invited disagreement. The more intensely you live, the more you choose to make a difference in the world, the more you create vital as opposed to insipid relationships, then the more open you are to whacks and bumps and bruises. That's the only path to honest, bottom-line communication. Who wins the highest office in a democratic society? It's the one who has made a career of attracting verbal abuse, deflecting it, and surviving in the biggest crap-taking business of all, politics. Want a taste of that? Get yourself appointed to any committee whose job it is to improve the status quo. Eventually, you'll meet dissension and resistance because most people oppose change. They will fight to keep things the way they are. It isn't just politicians and do-gooders who need advanced communication skills. Professionals such as law enforcement officers, teachers, healthcare providers, salespeople, service personnel, typical groups I'm invited to train, are learning how to use words to get what they need from others. People in these groups take verbal abuse for a living, and all of us do at one time or another. Parents certainly do, and so do students, homemakers, everybody. The key, then, is to learn how to avoid tumbling, or how to fall with grace without getting hurt. You will be attacked. There's little question of that. The real question is whether you'll become a stronger, more flexible person, or become more of a wimp. Even as an expert in this area, I face the temptation to fall into the traps all the time. Recently, I was driving to my office in Albuquerque when a kid who looked to be about 17 drove past me as I entered the parking lot and just missed sideswiping my new pickup. I was furious. When he got out of his car, I growled, "Where'd you learn to drive?" He looked at me calmly and announced, "Texas." Then he disappeared. By the time I got into my office, I realized I had met an unconscious combatant. He was a master of verbal judo and didn't even know it. He had stopped me with one word. Had he turned on me and matched my tone with a, "What's it to you, S.O.B.?" we'd have soon been in a shouting match, and who knows what else. 3 times his age, twice his size, and trained in martial arts and police tactics, I could have seriously injured him and ruined my life. But he hadn't even appeared upset when I yelled at him. Not only did he not seem to mind the attack, but he also appeared to enjoy it. That's how ancient samurai warriors viewed their battles. They lived for them. They were trained to see warfare as a joy and conflict as a sign that they were drawing more energy. The issue for them was not winning or losing, or even living or dying. The issue was bravely engaging, fighting with great style, learning from the encounter. And because the warriors welcomed warfare, they were less likely to be tense while engaged in it, less likely to shut down and forget their training. Quaden, "I am Bubba," Williams, and the reckless teenage driver shared an ease about confrontation. They were loose enough to respond with a simple, truthful answer that stopped their detractors cold. Williams did it with 3 words. The teen flattened me with 1. The secret is simple. It's okay if someone insults, resists, or attacks you. Laugh it off. Show that it has no meaning, no sting. If you fight back and resist the affront, you give it life and credibility. If you defend yourself, you invite counterattack. Look what happened when Richard Nixon declared, "I am not a crook." If, instead of lying or defending himself, he had early on merrily told the truth, without anger, defensiveness, or sarcasm, he might actually have survived politically. Imagine if he had said, "We got caught in a stupid move, and we're going to make it right." When I train cops around the country, I find that black officers are usually more adept at letting insults roll off them. Why? Probably because they have had to survive in a world that constantly attacks them. Many of them grew up playing a game called Dozens. Dozens teaches kids to handle verbal abuse. They learn looseness and agility in conversational play. The worst taunts imaginable, usually insults of each other's mothers, are hurled back and forth. "Yo mama's so stupid she heard it was chilly outside, so she brought out a bowl." "Oh yeah? Well, yo mama's so old she was born before slavery." Sometimes a shorthand version of Dozens is a simple insulting phrase, "Yo mama." What happens is that one player finally takes it personally and reacts in anger. He loses face and loses credibility. He also loses the game and is laughed at. By playing dozens again and again, a black kid eventually catches on that an attack carries only the weight he allows it to. He learns that if he makes no big deal of even an insult to his mother, there's no incentive for anyone to keep insulting him. He has learned to effortlessly, eloquently, and effectively disarm the cocked tongue. Chapter 5. The Nice, the Difficult, and the Wimp. Some Native Americans, primarily the Sioux and the Navajo, will look you in the eye under only two conditions. Either they happen to be your blood brother or sister, highly unlikely, or they're measuring you for the kill. Other Native Americans see a handshake as a sign of deference, and thus will offer a weak, open hand and close it gently, considering the vigorous gripping of a hand as a sign of aggression and superiority. Many Hispanics are taught not to even glance directly into people's eyes, an act considered by several cultures as snooping on the soul. Many Asians still observe the gesture of looking at one's shoes as a sign of respect. As our society becomes more culturally diverse, whites are quickly being displaced as a majority. There is a rising chorus of minority voices and an incalculable number of intercultural do's and don'ts to be learned. To calm someone brought up in the Western world, most people know to get out of his face and out of his space. Back off. Give him some room. Yet when dealing with someone from the Middle East, say an Egyptian or an Iranian, backing away from him would be the equivalent of telling Jewish American princess jokes at the local synagogue. Moving away from a Middle Easterner tells him he is unworthy of your respect. Better to move closer, to speak reassuringly, to tell him, it's going to be all right. Even a slight touch on the shoulder will do wonders. How do we keep track of all this? Move in? Step back, look a person in the eye, look at his feet. It could make you crazy. In Southern California, they've got a real challenge. In Garden Grove, a medium-sized city about 50 miles south of Los Angeles, at least 33 different languages represent more than 100 distinct cultures. Shopkeepers, gas station attendants, anybody who deals with the public has to routinely deal with all these groups. I've warned cops that if they serve even a minor felony warrant in a Thai or Laotian home, they've got to be extremely careful not to step or stand on the threshold. In those homes, the spirits of departed ancestors are believed to reside in the cracks of the threshold, and someone stepping or standing on that crack gives the resident the right to slap the offender upside the head. If you don't know the local customs and superstitions somewhere, it's better to politely ask, "May I come in? May I stand here? Do you mind if I..." I don't even attempt to train people in the subtleties of handling all the different peoples in the world. That would be virtually impossible. You'll be happy to know that there is a far simpler method for effectively dealing with people. All you need to know is that there are three basic types of people in the world, and each should be handled differently. These types cut across all cultures, races, nationalities, ages, and sexes. There are nice people, difficult people, and wimps. If you're in a position of authority, nice people will do what you ask them to do the first time you ask them. They like to cooperate. Tell a nice child to pick up his belongings, and he'll do it, probably right away. Tell a nice person to send in a payment, and the money arrives on time. Nice people don't shake their fingers in the boss's face. They don't complain to hotel managers that their room is too close to the elevator or not close enough. They don't send food back to the kitchen if it arrives slightly over or undercooked. My grandfather was a nice person. If he was stopped by a cop, he'd do exactly what he was told, automatically, even if the cop was nasty about it. As an attorney, he believed in the law more than he cared about a particular officer's execution of it. My grandfather would never give a cop any trouble, let alone anyone else. He considered it more egregious to make a scene than to make a point. Nice people often have such a hard time saying no or sticking up for their rights that entire books have been written about them, such as Codependent No More, The Doormat Syndrome, and Women Who Love Too Much. Nice people are not your problem, but it's still wise to treat them as if they're important. If you don't treat them well, they may do what you want, but will feel rotten about it. You'll lose credibility with them, and gradually they'll stop supporting you. Besides, just because they are cooperative is no reason to take advantage of them or take them for granted. treating them with respect is right because it's right. So few people are cooperative that you have to cultivate and cherish.